You're listening to the Namely Marley Podcast, episode number 28. Hey everyone, and welcome to the Namely Marley Podcast. I'm your host, Marley. The goal of this podcast is to focus on adding a little creative, healthy, and passion-filled living to your day every day. Today, I'm talking with Libby O'Connell. She's author of the book, The American Plate, A Culinary History in 100 Bites. I love history. I love reading historical fiction, and I particularly like authors like David McCullough, who create these wonderful stories about historical people and, you know, really helps you learn about the things that went on during their times. And they say it in just such a great story that, you know, you feel like you're reading a novel in some ways, but really there's all these facts that they've researched. Another great example of an author like that is Laura Hildebrand, who wrote Seabiscuit and also the more recent book, Unbroken. I've always had a fascination for people who love history. It's like I'm a one-off history buff. I'm not the one actually going out there and, you know, looking up all these historical documents, but I love reading from the people who do that. So recently I read another book that was like that. It did a wonderful job of telling the story of a historical perspective, but using food. Of course, this is the book that we're talking about today, The American Plate, and it was written by Libby O'Connell. I really fell in love with this book because, first of all, she just talks so much about some really great perspectives on food, and I think it made me a really good party guest because I would have all these little tidbits in my belt, you know, like, for example, did you know that the tomato did not originate in Europe? It actually originated in North America and was exported to Europe, and that's where the Italians took off with it. So people at a party would hear that and they would say, get out, that's crazy, or whatever. And so we would end up talking about that for a while, and it was really interesting. There's a lot of great tidbits like this in this book. And so whether you're a fan of history or not, you probably like food. And Libby points out that when we travel to other countries, one of the things we really want to do to really understand the culture is to eat the food. And so she actually says this in the interview, history is like another country. It's good to visit and try their food. And so she actually provides some recipes in the book that are from a historical perspective. And I really love this because if you think about it, we learn to cook from our mothers and our mothers learn to cook from their mothers and so on. And so getting an understanding of where some of these recipes originated from and maybe the times that they were going through and developing these recipes, the ingredients that they have on hand, I think it was all very interesting. We even talk about how some ingredients were named, for example, the eggplant, how it got its name. Libby talks a little bit about cookbooks and how they originated because, you know, we have oftentimes learned to cook from our mothers, but there were some people like immigrants who came over and didn't have the value of having their mother right nearby. So having cookbooks really helped kind of expand the culinary knowledge. We also talk about herbs. You know, I'm kind of new to this whole herb thing, and my cousin is a master gardener, and so I went out to visit her once, and she took me to what I would like to refer to as Herb Fest. There were herbs everywhere, and so I, of course, went home with some, and I still haven't killed them yet. I'm really impressed. I actually put my herbs in pots and take them back and forth, you know, as the winters get really cold here. I have to bring the herbs in, and I don't know. I just really love having herbs on hand, and so Libby and I talk about that, how important it is, you know, to use herbs, how they really freshen and brighten up a recipe. She also talks about the medicinal value of herbs and also the fact that you can use herbs for cleaning. As you can tell, I really love this interview. I'm really looking forward to sharing with you. I think you'll love it too. So let's get straight to it. Here's today's feature interview with Dr. Libby O'Connell. Hey everyone, I'm happy to have Dr. Libby O'Connell, a cultural historian and the author of an amazing book that I have right in front of me called The American Plate, A Culinary History in 100 Bites. She's on the show with us today. So Dr. O'Connell, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Marley, and please call me Libby. I'm happy to be here.
Thanks, Libby. You know, I read your book recently and I have just been, you know, obsessed with it since then. So I'm really looking forward to talking with you today. But first, before we get into all that, I just thought it would be nice if you could talk a little bit about, you know, what made you decide to become a cultural historian?
So one of the things I've always been interested in is daily life, the history of daily life. And my first job, you know, with the job that you get your first paycheck, not just some mom handing you cash after you've been watching their toddlers, right? My first job was as a interpreter at Plymouth Plantation, which is a first-person interpretation museum on Cape Cod that does a pretty amazing job of representing daily life in the 1620s after the arrival of the Mayflower. And of course, we all call, you know, people say that's the Pilgrims, right? But I was so trained never to call them Pilgrims because they did not call themselves Pilgrims. I always say the settlers on Cape Cod. And there I was in costume. I was had just turned 20, and I worked in several of the different houses, but often in the cooking house. And I learned a lot about 17th century food and how to cook over an open hearth, how to milk a cow and how to milk a goat. And I learned a lot about medicinal herbs as well as culinary and what we called strewing herbs, which are the herbs that you use inside your house for housekeeping.
Did that, you think, feed your interest in understanding the history of daily life?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I went on, after I graduated from Tufts, to after a little while, I went to graduate school and I got my PhD at the University of Virginia. And I studied court records, which sounds like a big shift from a kitchen to a court. But the truth is, there was so much illiteracy in early Virginia that a lot of the daily narrative took place in the court. Huh. They took no, you know, women would come in and say, I got this cow as a gift. Could you please write down that I have a cow? You know, you don't have that type of daily record in a court in most places, but in Virginia, that's what was going on. So by reading the court records, you learned a lot about daily life and the role of women, their property ownership, and as well as crime and punishment, which is always interesting too. Yeah. So that's how I got started.
Oh, that's great. And so I'm just curious, like how that segued into writing this book, which is really like this culinary history of North America. That's kind of a big leap.
Well, I was a, you know, for 22 years, I was a historian at the History Channel.
Really?
I helped, I worked on the team that started the History Channel. I was a historian, not a television business person. I'd had no background in TV, but I was a part-time professor and they hired me as an advisor. And then I went full-time and I worked there up until just recently. So I became comfortable with the idea of talking to the public about history.
Yeah.
It took me a long time. This was the hardest step. It wasn't moving from the history of the 17th century to modern day food. That wasn't the problem. The difficulty was moving from an academic voice to a voice for the public.
Oh, yeah.
And I just kept postponing writing my book because I thought, oh gosh, it's so much work and only 400 people are going to read it. And who's going to, you know, I don't think that way anymore. I'm outside of academic world. And then I realized that's okay. write the book that you want to now. You're no longer right out of graduate school. You've been in outside talking to people who actually don't know that much about history, and you know how to translate.
Yes.
So that's why I made that move. And the idea of talking about food comes naturally because I love to cook. I've, you know, raised my children as cooks, and I'm not a professional gourmet cook by any means, but I like my ingredients, and I like the stories. I like the storytelling that comes with food.
Well, it seems like there's a great parallel with history then too, because history, I think, is so much better when it's told in stories. So the story of history and the story of food comes together really nicely there.
Mm-hmm. I think it does. And I actually found while I was writing the book that it was a better vehicle than I even thought to understand the changes in American history.
Right.
So food provides this really great window, or even a door. It opens a door for different learners or people who wouldn't have described themselves as, oh, I'm somebody who loves history. But when you open that door through food, everybody likes food.
Right.
And I learned that when I was working at Plymouth Plantation because, you know, you go to a museum, and Marley, I bet you're one of those people who loves walking into museums and you spend a little extra time, and sometimes you're with friends who are looking at their watch saying, you know, hey, I think it's time for coffee. Why are we here? And those people go into the house of food where you're cooking over the open hearth and you're talking about how you made butter, and they stop looking at their watch and they get really engaged. So food engages the public in a topic like history in a way that surprises people, but it also entertains them and it informs them. So it all works.
I love it. One example that I can think of in particular is that I read the book by David McCullough called John Adams.
Yeah.
And you have a section. I mean, I felt like I had a pretty good understanding of John Adams after reading that book. But then you have a section where you talk about, is it whiskey or bourbon or whatever, like that he basically drank that every day. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, he drank a mug, not just a goat. He drank a mug of hard cider.
Hard cider, yes.
Every day for breakfast.
Oh my God.
But, you know, that's how he started his day.
Yeah.
And people will, sometimes it wasn't as strong as it is now. No, it could be. You know, they had different strengths. But, no, he had a mug of hard cider every morning, and he felt that it was healthy for him. I mean, yeah. He was looking at people he knew who would start their day with rum. So he felt virtuous, and really this was a good New England habit.
Yes, you know, definitely relaxes you.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is a friend of mine, Kim Gilmore, who's still a historian at the History Channel, she pointed out that, you know, we might take lots of people get up in the morning and have their breakfast and then have ibuprofen or a type of aspirin because something is hurting somewhere. Well, in the colonial period and certainly up until almost the Civil War, many, many people started their day with a lightly alcoholic beverage.
Yeah, that's an interesting point.
Yeah, yeah.
Very good. You know, I'm also on the park board here in our community, and we have a farm park, and we talk about how disjointed that we are as people from the process of creating our food. Like, you know, we get these products and we go home and we cook them, but we don't really realize where they come from. And I think that's maybe another thing that your book is helpful with, is realizing the origins of some of our food.
Yeah, I actually enjoy meat. I don't eat meat every day, but I do enjoy eating meat. But I think it's really important to remember where meat comes from.
Yeah.
Don't do it lightly. You know, don't be blithe about, don't just look at chicken in a wrapper and not really understand that it comes from an animal. Because it's very easy these days. So much of meat is presented in the store boneless and without any fat or skin or anything that makes you realize this is from a living creature.
I agree. I think if people knew the origins of their food more, I think we'd all be better off.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's fun. I remember going to a farmer's market several years ago and just being sort of taken aback by the number of colors of carrots, you know, those purple carrots and the orange carrots.
Yes.
And I've learned in my research that that's actually how carrots were up until the 100 years ago or
really?
Up until the 19th century. Because it's in the 19th century that you start reading cookbook writers saying, only buy the orange ones. They're the best ones for you. Now, I don't know if that's true, but they started this. Somebody out there said, you know,
yes,
this would have been about the 1840s, buy the orange carrots. Well, at that point, you start seeing more and more people just raising orange carrots because the market demand was for orange carrots.
Oh my goodness, we're so impressionable, aren't we?
I know. All those beautiful colors of carrots, they've been with us for thousands of years.
Wow.
Thousands of years. And it's only because of hybridizing the way they love to do in the 19th century, the one we do in the 20th, 21st.
Yes.
That brilliant assortment of carrot colors now reappears in our organic farmer's market and we think it's new.
Yeah.
But it's not new. It's just going back to the tradition of real carrots.
I don't know why I really love understanding the origin of a story like that. Like, why is it that we mostly see orange carrots? And that now makes a lot of sense.
Well, I didn't even know that they weren't all orange.
Yeah, that's true.
I thought carrots were orange.
Yes, and then they made other varieties. Yes.
Yeah. All right, here's a great story about food. We use a very old-fashioned word, eggplant.
Yeah.
Right. The British call it aubergine, which is the French word. But the 18th century word for this plant and 17th century word was eggplant because the most eggplants were white.
Oh.
Now, we've seen them. I know you've seen them.
Yes.
People who look in books, you can see. You don't have to buy it at the market. You know that eggplants come in white. They come in lavender and they come in that beautiful, rich purple.
Yeah.
But generally, we're buying the beautiful, rich purple. And if you want the fancy colors, you go to the farmer's market or you may grow them in your own garden.
Right.
But long ago, hundreds of years ago, when eggplant first came on the scene, they were originally from Persia. here are these big, they were mostly round. They weren't so much of a crook neck plant, you know, oval. Yeah. They were more rounder, like an egg. They were egg-shaped, like a big ostrich egg. And the way eggplants have the big leaves, and they sort of are hidden under their leaves the way zucchini are. You know, you sort of search for them in the garden. Uh-huh. And there would be, you would find the eggplants. They looked like an egg. They were hidden the way eggs are sort of hidden in the nest. And so people called them eggplants. And then once again, people writing, and I think this was earlier than the carrot story, in the 18th century. So around the time of the Revolutionary War, you start seeing people say, the purple ones are the best. I have no idea why they make these comments. They just, maybe they like them, because that was the time when eggplants made the switch from being decorative, purely decorative, to being eaten by Northern Europeans.
Interesting.
They were first eaten, they were from Persia, but Africans ate them a lot. And the African slaves that were brought over here ate them a lot. So they were called, in the South, eggplants were known as Guinea squash. And Guinea was a name for, Guyana, the west coast of Africa.
That is so amazing. I guess, you know, what's crazy is I never even questioned why we call it eggplant.
Well, it's a funny name when you think about it. Why is it called eggplant? It's dark purple. And
it's not shaped.
It's not shaped like an egg. Where is this coming from? Anyway, that's where it's coming from. It was originally kind of a creamy egg color, eggshell color.
I love this discussion. And I think something we were talking about before we hit record was that after reading this book and hearing this discussion with you, we are all going to be the most interesting party guests.
Well, you know, you can, when you learn about the history of food, you know, we love going to dinner parties, having, you know, eating with friends, going to weddings, enjoying that food. But every once in a while, you're at a dinner with some business associates or people you don't know that well, or maybe even a family member that you're thinking, oh my God, what do I say to them now? And the history of food is very handy for breaking ice. It really is.
It really is. And in fact, that leads me to my next question for you, which is, I was really impressed with some of the things that you talked in your book about that I think we associate as being probably native to other countries that actually originated in the United States. So I would love for you to talk about tomatoes.
Okay. Okay. So one of the main arguments in my book is that the past is like another country. And if you go to one country today, you want to go to the museums and you want to go to the marketplaces and you want to go visit the historic sites and do a little shopping, but you also want to try the food. Mm-hmm. Well, the past is like a different country and you want to try the food there too. And you will learn more about the culture. And one of the things you learn when you're studying American food is that tomatoes originate in Central America, mostly around in Mexico, okay? Mm-hmm. So they travel from the New World with the Spanish. The tomatoes are brought back to Europe by the Spanish, and people didn't really know what to do with them. But the other thing is that when they go to England or they go to France, you need a hot, sunny climate for tomatoes to grow well, especially in the days before greenhouses. So where do they grow well? They grow well in Spain, and they grow well in Italy.
Yeah.
So they become incorporated into the Italian diet very early, particularly in southern Italy, because it has that hot, those long, hot summers.
That's something that definitely floors people when I tell them that they're really surprised to hear that tomatoes started here.
Yeah. And by the way, polenta, not indigenous to Italy either.
Really?
And when you have, yes, because polenta is made out of what?
Corn.
You know, it's made out of corn, maize, which is native to North America. And so the Spanish brought that over too. And the funny thing, though, is that a lot of times you find that some foods went from South America or Central America to Europe through the Spanish and the Portuguese, right? Mm-hmm. And then 100 years later or 150 years later, the British settlers come to the North American colonies, right? They settle the North American colonies.
Yeah.
And they bring some foods back with them, like potatoes. Potatoes are not native to Ireland. Hello, people, Irish potatoes? No, they are a type of potato, but potatoes originated in the Andes. and they are really from Peru. They traveled around South America up to, you know, up through Central America into North America before the Spanish arrived. But they are not native to Europe in any way.
And
they're not native to India either.
Obviously, they got exported.
Yep, and cultivated.
Yes.
And they're very easy to grow, and they're very nourishing by themselves. And they thrive in the thin, rocky soil that could maybe not do so well growing other crops. And they really took off in Ireland.
And that's probably why, because of their soil.
Yeah. And you have, well, also because it's a very productive crop for small plots of land. And, you know, in the 18th and 19th century, little by little, farmers' plots were getting smaller and smaller in Ireland. The grains were being exported back to Great Britain, and the Irish were left pretty much with potatoes, maybe a pig, some cabbage. I mean, their diet was very limited.
Yeah.
And that is why we call potatoes, those white potatoes, Irish potatoes, but they're not from Ireland, any more than tomato sauce or tomato sauce is from Italy. So imagine pizza without any tomato sauce on it. It just seems like that's impossible.
It does seem impossible, yeah. I was also surprised to learn that I didn't actually realize the ingredient that Christopher Columbus was looking for when he took off.
Oh, pepper.
Yes, black pepper.
Yeah, yeah.
We take it so for granted nowadays, but I guess it was very, you know, a highly sought after item then.
Well, it was a very desirable spice, and it was imported from, they didn't really know where it was from, but it came across from Southeast Asia, and then across the trade routes of China and the Middle East. And there was a new group called the Ottomans. The Ottoman Empire was rising.
Oh, right.
And they were taxing the importation of certain goods. And one of the goods that they started to really tax on a very high level was pepper. So suddenly, a spice that had been a luxury item became way out of range for most people to buy. Mm. Do you see what I mean?
Yes.
It's not like everyday people ate pepper a lot. It was a luxury.
Right.
But suddenly, it was way out of sight. Then the Queen Isabella was very upset. She loved pepper. I mean, they realized, actually, they were early capitalists. They realized if they could get pepper without it being taxed, essentially, what Columbus said to King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella of Spain is, I will get this stuff for you wholesale. We'll bring it back. You guys will be rich. All right?
Yeah.
So he goes and he's going to sail across the Atlantic because he's going to get to Asia. And really, it makes sense. He was going to go around the other way, but he forgot. He didn't know. Nobody knew that there was this giant landmass called America, right, that blocked his way to getting cheap pepper. But he does find something called allspice, or Jamaican pepper.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And he finds, this is the source of confusion for the rest of the world for the rest of the time. He finds capsicum, which he calls red pepper.
Yes.
And red pepper is from the New World. And that is where it's from.
It kind of explains why they're named that way. Like, you know, why would black pepper and, you know, sweet bell peppers or red peppers? It's you know, very confusing sometimes.
Yeah, but they don't look anything alike.
No.
But they had that spice, you know, the hot red peppers had that spiciness. And so that's why.
And he was probably thinking, I can't go back empty-handed, right?
I can't go back empty-handed.
so look, I'll take this plant and I'll call it a pepper.
That's right. That's right. And later, people brought back potatoes. The Spanish brought back potatoes from Peru.
Yeah.
And they also brought back chocolate.
Ah, chocolate. That's a good step.
Yeah. I've heard some people like that.
Chocolate was imported.
Oh, yeah. I just actually gave a talk about this at the Smithsonian a couple of weeks ago. Chocolate originated from the cacao tree, which we know historically originated thousands of years ago on the foothills of the Andes, but nobody really made it in chocolate that we know of until a group around the time of the Olmecs. So 2000 BC, that's a really long time ago.
Yeah.
They started making chocolate as a beverage.
The powder.
Yeah, and they would drink it.
I actually do that today. I heat up hot water and I put cocoa powder in it, and I love it.
Well, they didn't have it as powdered like we have it, but they did make a type of ground powder with it, and chocolate was consumed as a beverage for thousands of years before it's eaten as candy. It is not eaten as candy the way we know it until the 19th century.
Was it kind of like a coffee drink?
Yeah. Yeah. But the Europeans sweetened it. Supposedly, we know that the Aztecs really liked, and the Maya too, the Maya Indians of Guatemala and the Yucatan, they liked to put chili pepper in it. So they would put in vanilla and chilies, and it was very bitter and spicy. Mm. And it was, you know, it was manly, and it was not, they didn't see it as an aphrodisiac, at least I haven't seen that. But they saw it as something that was going to make the warriors strong and brave, and the king got to drink it. And it was limited to ceremonies for the common people. They would have it at baptisms, at wedding rituals, and also at funerals. People would share the drinking chocolate.
For
the upper class, they could drink it more. It was very expensive, and it also was, you know, really desirable. And the Spanish Cortez sees Montezuma drinking a lot of this beverage that's very hot, very spicy. And he knows that Montezuma has 50 wives, right? Oh. So the Spanish make an association that, it's the chocolate that makes it possible to have, to keep all these women satisfied, right?
I see.
So when chocolate comes back to Europe as a beverage, the association, you know, it's spicy and all of these things. It's an aphrodisiac. And it's the nuns, supposedly. Now, this goes into the no written record here, but I've read it in a few places, but I love it so much. The nuns take out the chili, the hot chili pepper, and they add vanilla, which sometimes the Aztecs used, and sugar. And they add the sugar. And so instead of it being the drink of the devil, they make it the drink of the angels.
Just by taking the spicy out.
When adding sugar.
Yeah.
And so the nuns start drinking it. Ladies start drinking it in church. It becomes so popular, but it still becomes associated with lust and passion, even when the ladies are drinking it. That's a great story. Every once in a while, you'll run into a description of somebody killing their lover. But of course, she had been drinking a lot of chocolate. Oh, well, now we understand, you know? That certainly doesn't have to be punished for that. How would she know? She was taken away out of herself by this chocolate beverage, right?
Oh, it's good to have a reason for that then.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, it's a Twinkie defense, only it was the chocolate defense.
Oh, yeah, that's right. It's like things that we think are new are really not that new, right?
No.
Yeah.
But then they start eating chocolate in the 19th century. People like Fry's in Britain and Cadbury's and Whitman. It's really Hershey that makes it into Hershey and Mars make it into a candy for the masses.
Interesting, yes. Mm-hmm. Huh. Well, I know that it has a lot of health benefits to it. And that's one of the reasons I drink it, but I also just like it.
I force myself because it's supposed to be healthy for me. I'm just kidding. I love it.
I was going to say,
I have a little bit of a problem. I try not to have it around.
There are some people who don't really like it. It's interesting because a teaspoon of cocoa powder only has a few calories. It's very low in calories.
Well, it's the sugar that you add.
Yes.
I think it's a treat, and you should enjoy it as a treat and just not overindulge, right?
I completely agree.
Easy to say.
Always easy to say. My trick is just to not have it around, you know, as far as like sweets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm with you.
So something else I learned from your book, which really caught me by surprise, was that I think I read that the American Indians really did not have a lot of domesticated animals. In fact, maybe only dogs. We have these iconic pictures of them with horses and that's really not true.
No, the horses were introduced by the Spanish. The first horses that came to the New World was in 1493. So Columbus's second voyage, he brings over a lot of domesticated animals. But up until that time, the Native Americans in North America, what we call the continental United States and Canada, they had dogs.
Yeah.
Okay. South America, they had llamas. They also had dogs. They also raised the little the guinea pigs in the Andes. All right, mm-hmm. So they had these little like fat rodents that they kept as a meat supply, which is a good meat supply. And you can argue that there were so many types of wild birds like turkey and duck, and they were so plentiful that you never really had to have a hen house. You could just go out there and get it.
I see.
But that's different than domesticated animals that were available to you at any time of year.
Right.
This is a big change. It has a big impact on the environment, as you can imagine, the ecosystem, when you start introducing grazing animals.
Right.
Obviously, there were millions of American bison, but there were not wild horses. There were not cattle. There weren't any sheep. All of these things were going to have a big impact on what could grow. And not to mention the wild hogs. There were no wild hogs.
And they do a lot of damage.
They do a lot of damage.
Yes.
And some of the West Indies, some of the islands on the West Indies, the early settlers would sort of park domestic animals on small islands. Because instead of having to build fences, if you just put them on a small island where they couldn't leave, and there'd be enough food naturally growing for them to eat. And what would happen is that the pigs particularly, but also the sheep and the cattle, would strip the islands bare. And then they would erode, and then they would end up with very bad soil conditions and not be able to be arable anymore for generations.
So there's some pros and cons. I mean, as far as I believe they use the animals for work, tilling the ground, and obviously they would use horses for transportation, and mm-hmm. so that
and
there are some
ox.
Pros to that, but yeah. there were also some yeah. Ecological yeah. problems.
Yeah, but the Native Americans adapted horses and became among the best horse riders in the world. I think you could match them. I think there's, the Mongolians would argue that they are the best, but certainly the Crow Indians and other Indians are just amazing horsemen, just unbelievable. They were raised on horseback. And so the British settlers come, and by the time the British settlers arrive, the Plains Indians had completely adopted horses into their way of life.
So that's why we probably have these iconic images. It seemed like they already had them here.
Yeah, we had no idea.
Yeah.
The British settlers or the settlers from Northern Europe had no idea that even the Spanish didn't, I think, understand that they were the ones who had introduced the horse not that long ago.
It's just like you say, the story of the history of things. It's just, we take a lot of things for granted that, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We don't ever end up questioning. And that's just a great, like I say, I just had never thought about that before. So you also talked about sassafras in your book, and I just, yeah. I find that very interesting. I mean, you talk about a lot of ingredients, and I think people should definitely get this book and they should read it because it's just got great stuff. But sassafras is something that's, I think it's one of those things that's old and making its way back. My daughter said that she went to some hipster restaurant where sassafras was on everything. Have you heard of that? It's like a hipster movement.
Well, it's, it's so easy. Foraging is a hipster movement, right? I mean,
beards.
You go into any, but you go into any good restaurant or farm-to-table restaurant in the spring, and early spring, and you're going to get ramps, wild
yes.
onions. And
yes.
the ramps are here. And you think, really? I don't want any. But a lot of people love them.
Yeah.
And it's fun to have fresh food. And it's fun. Sassafras grows in my on the hedgerow, on the corner of our lawn. So it's fun to have things that
yeah.
you can just walk outside and pluck. You don't have to go to the nursery, and you don't have to worry about, leave enough for others. There's just
yes.
tons of it. And it dries very easily. And what I didn't know is that it actually thickens things. It can be
really?
Used as a thickener. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Is it easy to buy? Like if I didn't have a sassafras growing in my yard, I could go buy some?
Yeah, I think so. I don't think you can get it at at your regular supermarket. You can go online and buy it.
Okay.
But it has a nice fresh taste to it. I like it.
I'm going to have to try that because, I'm vegan, so we're always looking for things to thicken things. That would be great.
Yeah, you can It's not going to thicken things the way, certainly not the way cornstarch does or flour, but it can add body to a soup, for example. Huh. Yeah, try it. Give it a try. It has a strong taste.
I've heard people talk about using it in a tea as well. Is that right?
Yeah, you can use it. It's not going to hurt you. Although, remember, it's not going to cure syphilis.
Oh, yeah.
That's why, that was like, who knew that? I mean, that is a great story that they, you know, the Indian nations, well, mostly Algonquins along the East Coast used sassafras as a medicine for lots of different diseases. And the Europeans were suffering from this very aggressive form of syphilis at that time. And the settlers were thrilled to have found the medicine, the cure, the miracle cure, right?
Yeah.
But soon enough, people figured out that actually does not cure sexually transmitted diseases.
Well, that told me two things. One, that marketing is something that's been around for a long time. And two, they really did not have a lot of medicine back then.
Well, you know, what they had were what was called heroic medicine, which is the really most dangerous medicine in the world, which is not just mixing up vile things, which if it didn't taste bad, it wasn't going to work. But they, you know, they were doing a lot of bleeding people.
Mm, right.
And purging them, using emetics to make people throw up, or using purges to make people's bowels move intensely so to clean out their systems. And it sometimes just killed people. You were better off not going to a doctor, I think, really, until most of the 19th century.
Yes. I mean, we didn't have names for a lot of the diseases that we have today, weren't even available back then, you know?
Yeah. I mean, there were some things like, you know, there was early recognition about vaccination.
Yeah.
And the importance of vaccination. And because smallpox was so deadly, and, you know, people knew how to be vaccinated by the 18th century in Britain and in America, in the American colonies. And of course, that had been invented in the Middle East, I think.
Have you read that book, Scourge?
No.
It talks about smallpox. No. It's just an amazing story about, you know, the creation of that vaccination and how they transported it around using boys, I believe they said, that would keep the virus alive.
It's awful.
I know, it's terrible.
They did. There was this Dr. Jenner, you know, he invents a safer smallpox vaccination, and the child was known as Jenner's boy. You know, the talking about vivisection of animals, they were doing it with little boys.
Yes,
you know,
exactly.
Sort of, you know, nobody wants these kids. At least they can help with medical breakthroughs. And in fact, they did.
Yes.
I'm not justifying. It's just a different way of looking at life and the value of life.
Right.
We can't use our assumptions and feelings to understand that.
Yeah, and they were using whatever ingredients were around. And so obviously they looked to their herb garden. And I think there's a lot of truth, honestly, to medicinal value of herbs.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think you were much better off going to your local herbalist, your wise woman.
Yes.
Because she probably couldn't hurt you as much as a regular doctor could.
Right.
But you know, a cup of mint tea is good. It does soothe your stomach.
Yes.
And the water would be boiled, right?
Right.
So the water itself would be safer.
Yeah.
And they used those remedies. Sage was supposed to help with headaches, and borage was supposed to give you courage, partially because it rhymed. and, you know, the whole doctrine of signatures, which is so funny. The idea that if the leaf looks like something in your body, then that leaf would be good as a tea for your body. So if something had heart-shaped leaves, then it would be good for your heart. And it's not really a good way to tell what's going to work and what's not going to work.
Probably not.
No.
But you also talk about the cleaning value of herbs. I mean, obviously, we know about lavender.
Right. But I grow a lot of something called rue, R-U-E.
Yeah.
It looks beautiful in a bouquet. It has a very small leaf that is a blue-green, like the color of a blue spruce. Mm. So it's an unusual color. It has quite a bitter smell. But I use it in my pantry because it keeps away those Miller moths. You know those little moths that can come in from the stores?
Yes.
And you open up something and there are the maggots, and you just think, oh my God, where did that come from? you know, the little worms that are crawling in your brown rice.
Yes.
And you think, oh, this is because we don't use pesticides on our food anymore.
Yeah.
So now we see this. But the one way to deal with that is to put some rue on your shelves. Don't mix it in with your food directly, but you can just buy rue at the nursery, even if you don't have a garden, and just a few sprays of it will help keep insects out of your kitchen.
Well, that reminds me of something else in your book, because you talk about, is it a potager? Is that what you call that? A little garden that you keep by your house?
Yeah.
I love the idea of this. And so I want to, you know, if I'm going to have that in my yard, I would love to plant some rue. That's a great idea.
Yeah. Well, it needs a lot of sun. But I actually, I'm a big believer that if you don't have much space, you can use fresh herbs to make the vegetables that you bring back from the farmer's market or from your local store and really make them your own and really perk up the flavors, because there's nothing like fresh herbs to brighten the flavors that you're serving to your family and friends and to yourself.
Right. I actually keep my herbs in pots, because that way in the winter I can move them inside.
Yeah. Well, that's good.
Yeah, they don't all survive.
They don't thrive necessarily, and their flavor, it gets a little not as strong.
Yes.
But that's okay, and they look pretty too.
They're beautiful. Mm-hmm. So my favorites are sage. I've done really well with maintaining sage. And for some reason, sage and parsley do great. But I do have a hard time with basil. For some reason, I don't think I water it enough. I don't know. But the oregano goes wonderful inside.
Yeah, oregano, well, they're sturdy.
Yes.
Basil's not as sturdy, and it's a little finicky, and you can grow it successfully inside. Yeah, don't overwater it, but it does need a lot of sunshine.
Mm.
I grow thyme inside because I love thyme. It's
I
one of my
too.
Favorites. And I also grow rosemary, and rosemary, really, gosh, that's
I love that
hard.
Stuff.
I do too. But
I have a hard time with it.
Mm-hmm. It's not, I mean, let's be real. This isn't that difficult, but it always kind of, by this time of year, my rosemary plant, which is pretty big. It's about 3 feet tall.
Yeah.
It's looking kind of peaked. You know, it definitely needs to go outside soon. It's saying, I want the real sun, not just sun through a window.
Not just this fake stuff. Yeah. Mint is another one. I mean, mint is like a weed in the summer, but for some reason, when I bring it inside, it doesn't do very well.
No. And you know what? It's a perennial. It likes going dormant. It likes the sleepy time.
Okay.
Whereas rosemary is a shrub, and you can find it in the Mediterranean climates, like in California, or you know, in the Mediterranean.
Yes.
And it grows all year. Even in Virginia and Washington D.C., if you have a brick patio, say, people can keep rosemary all winter long. So because it's a woody shrub. It's got bark.
And so flavorful.
I know. I love it.
I do too. And it goes so well in so many things. And I agree with you. Like just, even if you could just identify a few herbs that you could plant and keep them, and they just make such a difference in your finished meals.
Yeah. And you know what? When the nice thing about growing your own is that you can actually have enough so that when people come over, or even just by yourself. I use sage because sage is, as you said, it's kind of a sturdy plant, right? And it makes a wonderful garnish just on a platter.
It does.
It makes anything pretty.
It does.
Yeah.
It's so true. Now, okay, just really quickly, I know we're getting, you know, close to time here, but I would love to talk with you about cookies because it sounds like we have the Dutch to thank for giving us those rich, delicious cookies that we all enjoy.
Well, we have the Dutch to thank for giving us the word cookie. Every other English-speaking country, the Commonwealth nations, Canada, India, Hong Kong, Great Britain, of course, Ireland, Australia, they call a crispy, sweet something a biscuit.
Yes.
And we call them cookies. And that word is from the Dutch. And of course, the Dutch were here not for very long. They were only here for about, I mean, they only owned the colony of New York or New Netherlands for, I'm going to get this wrong, I hate to say it, like a generation or two. But they left a very strong legacy, and part of it was in food. And they were the, you know, of course, they owned the big spice markets of the 17th century. They became very rich because of the spice trade and then because of the fur trade that they accessed through their connections in through New York. And they made wonderful baked goods. When you add the rich dairy from the Dutch traditions, the butter and the cream, and then their spices, plus in the New World, in North America, the price of sugar is a lot cheaper than it is in the rest of the world. It's still a luxury item, but it's going to be cheaper because you're much closer to the source of production, which is in the West Indies and Brazil. And it's those ingredients that make the cookies that the Dutch become famous for. And America's cookies, when you go to the supermarket, look at what our cookies look like and then look at the imported ones. The imported ones look like sort of crackers with some sugar, a little sugar in them.
Yes.
And ours look like candy bars. Right? They have all these layers of filling and chocolate covered coating and all of this stuff going on. They're very sweet and very rich, and partially because people like that.
Right.
And we had so much access to sugar.
Yes. I actually read somewhere that some of the early cookbooks referred to cookies as little cakes.
Yep.
I could see where, you know.
A lot of the little cakes were made, there was something called Naples cakes, which I know were Washington's favorites. And we would today think they were very, very bland. You know, they were sort of mild, sweet.
But to them,
he liked them. They liked them.
Yes.
Yeah. They weren't saying, where's the chocolate sauce? No, they didn't.
I think there's something to be said for maybe reducing the sugar a little bit and allowing the flavors.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. It's very interesting. There's a Boston School of Cooking, you know, Fannie Farmer, who helps invent the standard measurement of cooking, the science of cooking, sort of using measuring cups and level tablespoons and those things. She was a wonder at that. And it really helped the amateur cook learn how to cook, because if you're not home in Czechoslovakia with your mother saying, no, honey, it's like this.
Yes.
And you are an immigrant, young immigrant woman expected to know how to cook, a cookbook that tells you exactly how much goes into a recipe makes a big difference in your life.
Yes.
And that's one reason why, you know, Americans loved the Fannie Farmer information that they got from her cookbooks, because they weren't home with mom learning how to cook. They came over as young women.
Oh, right.
And, you know, the first cookbook, I love this, the first cookbook in Italy that uses standard measurements doesn't come out to almost 50 years after the Fannie Farmer, the Boston Cooking School cookbook.
Wow.
So it's because the Italians are all at home, right? And,
you know, right.
And Nona's saying, no, add more. You know, she's right there. So you see it. And you have this sort of sense of sort of innate understanding of how that dish is made. You would not turn to paper and say, oh, I have to have one tablespoon. No, you said, the butter the size of a walnut. Right?
I mean, honestly, it's like I can see the dilemma in this conversation, because there are some people who are kind of advocates for intuitive cooking, and you know, but of course, you need someone to show you how to do that. And you know, on the flip side, the recipe writes it out for you.
I am at this point in my life. I've been cooking for many, many years, and I think of myself as an intuitive cook.
Yeah.
And I should be by this point, right?
Yes.
Although there's still some things that I want to get measured. If I'm making pie crust, for example, I still need to start with that. But that may be because I only do make pies a few times a year. you know, but the things that you make every day, you know how to do them without a recipe.
Right.
But really, we aren't born intuitive cooks. You do need to practice.
Yes.
You need to practice. And you can experiment and try. Oh, let's try some allspice in this. A lot of Americans no longer use allspice except in holiday baking goods.
Mm-hmm.
When allspice could be a nice flavor to add to yogurt or to vegetables.
Yes.
It's just different. It's a different flavor.
Right.
A little bit like nutmeg, but it doesn't have to be restricted to cinnamon cookies or something.
Well, the nice thing is too, there's health benefits to some of these spices. So, you know, I think mixing them up is kind of good from that perspective too.
Oh, I'm a big believer in turmeric. I take,
yes.
I, I, uh, yeah. there's some spices that we know.
The anti-inflammatory properties of turmeric. Yeah.
Yep. Absolutely.
Yeah. So yeah, if I have an opportunity to sprinkle that on in some of my soup, or you don't have to put a lot. I love it. This is great. I love this conversation. I think I could talk to you all day, but I feel like we got to wrap things up. So
we've been talking for a while.
I know. So what's coming up next for you? Anything that you can share?
Mm-hmm. Yep. I'm writing my next book, and it's called The President's Plate, and it's about food politics and identity in American culture.
Wow, that could be a very deep discussion. There's that whole, are you going to talk about different presidents and their affinity for certain foods?
Yep, I am. But also why they use certain foods to represent who they were to the public. For example, a very well-known president, he's not that well known, William Henry Harrison, who, everybody knows him.
Yeah, my favorite.
he's famous actually for being the shortest lived president. He died very shortly after he was inaugurated. Right. But his campaign slogan was hard cider, log cabin and hard cider, to show that he was a man of the people, right? And he was campaigning against Martin Van Buren, who was considered sort of elitist. And so William Henry Harrison was showing he was a regular guy. He drank hard cider. He didn't drink fine French wine. Well, one reason why this is such an interesting slogan is that William Henry Harrison is the son and grandson of old Virginia family. I mean, this guy was raised at a table where fine French wine was being consumed. It's just that during his days as a military commander, when he was out on the front, he would drink beer and hard cider with the guys. But he was not from that background at all. He was from a very elite background.
Old themes continue to be repeated. We want to vote somebody in that we feel like we can have a beer with.
That's right. Exactly.
I never quite understood why that's an admirable characteristic, but oh well.
I know. Why does this come to play as a precedent, right? Excuse me, but are you good at drinking beer?
Yeah, it's interesting from the perspective of a book to look at each of the presidents and, their relationship to food. That's cool.
I'm also be talking about food policy and not to neglect the women and the staff at the White House. Mm-hmm. And the White House was largely staffed originally by slaves and then African Americans in the cook in the kitchen, and the role that they had in bringing the fine flavors of Africa along with the Southern cooking into what becomes a truly American cuisine. So that's a very interesting story as well.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that book. I can't wait to read it.
All right.
So I've got a couple of fun questions for you here at the end of the interview. What's one food item you can't live without?
Eggs.
Eggs. Okay. How do you cook them? Do you have a favorite way?
Oh, I eat them scrambled. I eat them poached. I eat them in custard. I use them in cooking a lot. To me, eggs and arugula. There are a lot of things that I eat every day. I mean, I could just have salad and arugula at every meal.
I love arugula. And if there's a mix and it's got that in that, I just love the flavor of it.
I do too. I love the flavor of it.
Yes. I've never really had much luck growing my own. Have you tried that?
You have to be very quick. Yeah. But it you have to keep sowing it. Do you understand?
Oh, when yes.
So when it comes up, as soon as you start seeing it, you have to sow some more. It's like cilantro. It just doesn't have a long life. It goes to seed very quickly. So you just keep harvesting, but keep sowing more.
Is that why it starts to get bitter if you wait too long?
Uh-huh.
I love this. We're learning a lot. Okay. So there's so many great cooking shows that are out there today. I'm just curious if you watch any or do you have a favorite?
No, I don't. I don't watch the modern ones, although I will say they've done a wonderful job of getting the public interested in cooking again.
Yes.
And kudos to them because they really have made a difference. And I have nephews and nieces who watch them regularly and have become really good, inspired to be good cooks. Yeah.
Yes.
So that's, but I do, every once in a while, I'll watch old shows with Jacques Pepin,
the French chef.
And he was a friend of Julia Child, and you watch him cook and you think, talking about an intuitive cook, he's putting his hands into the fat that's frying. I mean, it's oil, right? That he puts some vegetable into boiling oil, and then he just turns it with his hands. And
oh,
you
my
think,
goodness.
Oh, my God, that wouldn't be allowed to be on television anymore. Oh, I'm sautéing this, but I have a little extra oil. And then he just flips it around with his hand. I think, my God, he must just have hands made out of calluses by this point.
He must. There are burn marks all over everything.
I know. Burn marks everywhere. And when I was a kid, I used to have burn marks all up and down my arms from baking cookies and stuff like that.
I have a few myself, and there's you know, usually stupid stories surrounding them, like, you know, dropping the pan or whatever, and nothing glamorous like sticking my hand in the pan.
Well, that's not glamorous. And I'll tell you one thing a cook learns quickly is not to wear bracelets when you're cooking, because if you have a bracelet on and it touches a pan, let's say you've been roasting vegetables at high heat, and your metal bracelet comes in contact with that pan, it'll conduct the heat right to your arm.
Oh.
And I ended up a couple of years ago with a bracelet burn.
Oh,
I mean,
gosh.
It was really bad. And I thought, that's so stupid, Libby. What were you thinking? But
never again, right?
No, never again.
Okay, so what inspires you?
Oh, well, smells inspire me. I find fragrances really evocative.
Mm.
And I try to replicate them in my kitchen. They are intrinsically linked to taste, obviously.
Yes.
But I really enjoy eating outside in the spring and summer and the fall whenever I can. And that sense of sunlight on my food. Isn't that funny? But I think it makes it enhances the aromas.
It's beautiful. So Libby, how can people find you online?
Well, they can come to my website, LibbyO'Connell.com. They can follow me on Twitter. I'm Dr. Libby History, and I tweet a lot, not only about food, but also about history and preservation. And you can buy my book. That's the most important thing, The American Plate.
I'll leave a link in the show notes page.
Okay, that would be great.
Libby, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today. I had a great time.
Oh, Marley, we should do this again. It was really fun.
I'd love that. Thanks to Libby O'Connell for being my guest on today's episode of the Namely Marley podcast. If you'd like more information about today's show, just head over to the show notes page at namelymarley.com/podcast. Tune in next week as I talk to Tess Challis. She's an author, vegan chef, and wellness coach. I'm talking to her about her recent book, Food Love. If you're intrigued by a vegan diet and want to learn more about how you can use that diet to be your best, you are going to love this interview. I am really looking forward to sharing it with you. I hope you're loving the Namely Marley podcast. If so, there's a couple of ways you can pay it forward. You can head over to iTunes or Stitcher and leave a review. You can share this episode with your friends and family on social media, and you can share about it on your blog or podcast. All of these are really helpful, and they really mean a lot. So until next time, may health and happiness come your way today.